back yesterday, very late, and only found out yesterday that it was on the schedule this morning. So I had to rush a little bit.
In our defense, we said,
yeah, we said check the schedule.
In our defense.
Yeah,
right.
It's all my fault.
So I pulled an all-nighter, and if I fall asleep, you should wake me. This is the only way around the So the stuff I want to talk about today is work I've done with my student, Dan Mirberg. He affected all the work, of course, I should say. Well, I shouldn't forget Pierre Stefano, of course, who did most of the 2D projections that are also necessary to actually look at what happens in the actual CMB. It appeared in January. And if time permits, I will probably add a little bit of new stuff. This is a little bit preliminary, but I hope we'll get there. So let's start with a little bit of an introduction. I think this morning you already learned that, that inflation is a very interesting tool, as far as I'm concerned, to try to learn about very high energy physics, I would say, because it's, it seems to be UV sensitive. And there are all kinds of ways to deal with that, and I am already spent 1 hour this morning on that. And I want to do something completely different. So what I want to do is think about the initial state. This is apparently one of my hobbies for the last couple of years, so I've been worried about this for quite a number of years now. And in fact, the perspective that I want to take today during this talk is that although there are some constraints you have to satisfy, you can't really exclude vacuum state projections. So in principle, of course, all the stuff in machine literature involves considering this initial state during inflation to be a steady state. And that's an excellent choice. It introduces our degrees with everything we see. And theoretically, it seems to be, well, maybe favored, but I mean, you cannot really exclude corrections. And in fact, I would say, if you start thinking about it in an effective field theory context, you might even expect that. Because the von Stabenitz state, really, formally speaking, assumes that free field theory is an accurate description all the way to the very, very highest energy scales, which cannot be right. So, because, you know, at some point you would think the relevant operators would jump in, inflation should be an effective field theory. At some point, the relevant operators jump in. It should be an interacting theory. It should not be a free vacuum state, therefore, therefore, maybe the von Stabenitz state can be a correct state. And on the other hand, we also don't know what happened before inflation, and that could give you trace on the initial state as well. So, of course, you have to satisfy certain constraints, and I listed two of them here. One of them is quite obvious. Of course, you have to satisfy the constraints of the data. And in fact, one of the things I always try to get across is that the power spectrum alone, the two-point function, already gives you quite good constraints. You cannot just do anything. You cannot just put any state here. It has to be relatively close to von Stabenitz, because otherwise you will already violate the power spectrum data. And of course, you also have to be careful that you don't, you know, if you start adding quanta, very high energies, if you occupy states at very high energies, you should, of course, satisfy back against some constraints. So there are some constraints. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to take a very pragmatic, phenomenological, effective field theory point of view, and I'm going to allow for small corrections to the von Stabenitz state at scales below some cutoff, lambda, or in fact, it's going to read m progressively, but that's the first error I noticed. And I'm going to study its signatures. And the signature I'm interested in today is actually the three-point function. Because the surprising thing is that it turns out to be very sensitive to what kind of initial state you put in. So, when I was writing my slides yesterday, I thought, let's get the message across early, because who knows what happens afterwards. The executive summary should be that the bispectrum is extremely sensitive to Morris-Davis modifications. And that's because when you calculate the bispectrum in three-point function in these modified initial states, the lonesome cutoff scale, turns out that there are enhancement factors appearing that have to do with the cutoff that you need to use. So those are these factors, K1 F naught, and they are equal to M over H. It's basically, this is the cutoff scale divided by Hubble scale. This can be a relatively large number. Let's assume that smaller, M is smaller than the Planck scale, but it's bigger than H, so it could be somewhere typically between like 10 to the 2,000 in that range. Those factors appear in these calculations and they enhance the three-point function. Now, typically, when you look at a bispectrum, it's not a function of one parameter. It's, of course, a function of the angles in the triangle. And in fact, what you typically find when you study the bispectrum in the presence of this modified initial state is that they are localized in this plane. So this plane actually describes the allowed region. This is the allowed parameter region for the angles or for some parameters that the bispectrum depends on. Actually, it can be cut in half because there's a symmetry. But nevertheless, I've plotted here two copies of it, essentially. And these enhancements are typically localized in this domain. So it's not like the full bispectrum is enhanced, but typically you'll find it in some region. And for these modified initial state cases, you'll find that it gets enhanced, well, not always, but typical case, gets enhanced near this line y is 1 minus x. So this plot is a colored plot of the basically the amplitude of the three-point function. So white means that it's high, and dark means it's low. And what you also see is that there are oscillatory effects in this bispectrum. So this is also what you typically find. And another thing, so even though there's a large number involved, so it gets enhanced, this particular shape of this three-point function is completely different from the shapes that we considered that have been compared to the data. So the local and equilateral shapes, they're very inadequate to actually probe these kinds of generalities. So this means that the constraints that you can get from the data up to now are perhaps not the strongest, but nevertheless, I will try to write down at some point an actual constraint and see it's not so bad. In some sense, it's already competing with the power spectrum, the constraint on modified initial state of the power spectrum. Okay, so that's the executive guess.
So the patterns don't change as you change k.
This is a ratio. So I'll explain what this ratio actually is. But this is the domain. So this is these are the ratios. It depends on the angles in the triangle and the scale of the triangle. Now, these bispectra are scale invariant, you can take one of these k's out, and then you have two variables left. And those are ratios of k. This is k2 over k1, and this is k3 over k1. So actually, this bispectrum does depend on these.
But overall k, if you change it, this pattern won't change.
No, it's scale invariant. Yes. I'll explain. In what on what circumstances it actually is given
that. It depends on modification you have, right?
Yeah. So it depends closely on what kind of modification I consider.
And what about the Dubin function? I mean, Dubin function is not as sensitive to modifications in the initial state.
No.
Why are you focusing on the bispectrum?
I'm focusing on the bispectrum because, well, there's a reason. The two-point function, you're just probing a free theory. And there's a huge difference between the three-point function and its sensitivity to the initial state and the two-point function in the sense that if you add, for example, high limiting interactions, then suddenly the three-point function becomes extremely sensitive to the modification in the initial state, whereas the two-point function only just a little bit. So it's because of the presence of interactions that this happens. And interactions are probed by the three-point function, not by the two-point. Right? Does that make sense? So That's what this exercise will show.
Okay.
Yes.
Is that true? Just for, I mean, would the bar spectrum be probing this initial state effect in a proper way if you don't have derivative interaction, just standard canonical slow?
Yeah. Okay. Good. So without any interactions, well, you cannot turn gravity off. So there are always interactions, right? So, and these are also enhanced in a way. But they're not, so, but there's more enhancement if you add interaction in the scalar sector. And the enhancement that you get by just looking at plain vanilla slow roll inflation without any high derivative terms, there are enhancements, but as I will try to show, these enhancements, if you try to constrain them or if you try to look at their projections basically in the local and equilateral shapes, they disappear, these enhancements. sorry, I still have to mention the outline. So I'll start with some bispectrum preliminaries because they are kind of important for what I'm going to say. Then I'll move on and do the standard slow roll calculation. This is in some sense repeated work because two people in the audience here know exactly what I'm going to do because they were the first one to do it. We agree with them. But we did something extra by pointing out that, you know, we looked at the projections into the actual observational shapes that have been tested. So we really try to calculate in products with the observational shapes to see how well you can constrain these kinds of modifications. So then I'll add the high derivative correction, which was also done by Richard and Edward. If I have time, I'll add some ongoing work about DBI. There's some reasons to think that the results don't change, but actually we do find a change there, and I'll come back to that if I have time, and I'll add some conclusions. So, some preliminaries on how actually these are those that are about measuring the three-point function. So, let's define general three-point function in the following way, right, with an amplitude, the delta function, and some shape function. Now, looking at that expression, it suggests a natural best estimator, so how you go about measuring such an amplitude. What you would do is actually take the data and take the in product with some theoretical shape that you think might describe this data, sum over all the triangles, and then normalize it. So it's important that you understand that when you measure Dongaussian, when you measure the three-point function, we don't measure just one triangle. We have to sum over all triangles, just for statistical reasons. Which is, it would be good if we could lose that constraint, but so far this is the best we can do. Now these sigmas, these are just the variances in the two-point function that we basically just, you know, the errors that we have to also keep into account. Now this is the so-called 3D best estimator. So we're assuming here that we have a three-dimensional data set. We don't, we do in some sense, but the best data set we have in CMB is a 2D data set. But it's, as I will briefly explain probably, the 3D construction is going to differ very little from the 2D construction. You can project basically the objects that you can define using the 3D data set. It's a difficult calculation, but the end result will not change too much if you project it onto the two-dimensional sky. So it's important to realize that if you have a perfect template, let's say that the template that you actually introduce here, this F, is spot on, then of course what you do is you take the data, which is basically the three-point function that you integrate over the sky, and you divide by the norm of this theoretical shape function, and you get the amplitude. That's it. So then you have the constraint on the amplitude. Now, of course, in real life, we don't know. This is just an arbitrary guess. So we should really think about using this to define an in product. So this is what's defined here. So I can take the in product between two different shapes, defined like this. And you can also define, based on that, a normalized inner product. Basically, something that doesn't anymore depend on the norms of these shape functions. And basically, this cosine function tells you how different two different shapes are. That's it. And then, from there, you can also define a so-called fudge factor, which will be the most important thing for the purpose of my talk. And the fudge factor basically tells you what the leakage is, how to translate a constraint, or let's say local non-Gaussianities, into a constraint on these theoretical shape functions that I will consider. So it tells you about the leakage of the theoretical signal, Fy, into the observational template Fx. So you can translate constraints that way. Now, as I already briefly explained, so what you typically do is you assume scale invariance of the three-point function, which means that you can scale out one of these momenta, k1 say, and then the shape function becomes a variable of x2 and x3, where x2 and x3 are the ratios of these remaining momenta with respect to k1. And of course, the triangle constraint tells you that there's a particular domain that these x2 and x3 have to lie in, and that's defined in the following way, that defines a this space, these constraints define a triangle in x2, x3 space. So that's the domain of this three-point function, essentially, or this shape function. Now, before I move on, I should also explain that, for example, the shapes that have been considered so far, they have a particular property, namely the local shape that has been compared to the data, has a three-point function that basically peaks for squeezed triangles. So this one. So it's in this triangle that you find the maximal signal for the local, for local non-Gaussianities. DBI inflation are more general models that have interactions in the scalar field sector. They peak at the maximum signal in equilateral triangles. And then there's only one possibility left. There's another limit of these of triangles that you can consider, and that's the unfolded or collinear, squeezed, whatever, triangle. And it turns out that this is something that naturally appears when you start modifying the initial state. Not always, and I will come back to it, but it's something that you'll see. So all this stuff I just wanted to briefly explain because it will play an important role in my talk, and also because I guess the first one talked about Gaussianities. So maybe, I don't know, if there are other talks about the subject, this will be helping you then the next week. Skip it. This was all described in this paper in 2004. And now it's given an insight to that. So it's long stuff. Now, so why are there only two templates, say, that have been compared to the data? So let me first define them. So this is basically the definition of FNL local based on the previous slide where I defined an amplitude. So I scaled out the K1, the scale invariance, a bit. And this is, by definition, FNL local. So it's just proportional to the amplitude. You can also define an FNL equilateral in the same way. Right? This is just the measured, the measured, the co-renormalization, which is a two-point function, so to say. And in that case, by defining the amplitudes in this way, the shapes of the equilateral template, they are equal to this, it's equal to this, and of the local shape, it's equal to this. Now, what you notice is that these templates are special in the sense that they're factorizable. And the fact that they're factorizable in x2 and x3 has a huge benefit. It means that the numerical work you have to do to prepare the data to the theory is a lot easier, and you can do it in less than an infinite amount of time, which is kind of useful. So that's why these templates have been, these are ones that have been compared to the data and for which we have reasonable constraints. So the 5-year results are listed here. these will be used also in this talk at some point in the end. So here's the plot again. This is a solid plot where, again, white means that it's peaking, and black means it's almost zero. Okay, so you see that the equilateral actually peaks in this region. So that's actually the region where you're considering equilateral triangles on equal side. And local peaks in these two regions, here and here. Note that there's a symmetry here, so I could have cut this picture around, which is basically the squeezed, or the, sorry, yeah, the squeezed triangle that I showed on the previous slide. Okay, that's where, it's where the local shape is peaking. Okay, good. Now, I want to explain to you the basic calculation. What do you do when you modify the initial state in basic slow normal inflation? So, in principle, of course, you can, if you just do anything, the initial state could also have a scale. I mean, it could have could be a false, all kinds of it could be arbitrary what you have here. But what we'll do is we'll consider an initial state psi naught, which is Gaussian. So if you now start to calculate this three-point function in an interaction picture, so that means you evolve the state with the interaction Hamiltonian and the fields with the free Hamiltonian, then basically you can get to leading order in the interaction Hamiltonian, basically two parts. So there's this part, which then disappears because it's a Gaussian state, so you don't have a three-point function, and then you expand basically the you take the leading term from the exponential, from the time development of the state, to give you this term. And this can be, basically using the fact that it's random, the fact that this has to be real, you can actually write this as follows, in this way. So instead of a commutator, this is just an ordinary expectation value that you can calculate using Wigg's theorem. You can write it in terms of two-point functions, essentially. So, and the crucial thing that you should notice is that when I calculate this time evolution of this state, I start from a time eta naught. So I will only consider scales, I will only consider modifications to the quantum state from some time eta naught, which basically is defined by some scale, cutoff scale n. Okay? So, that means that I will define this eta naught as it will be a k-dependent function in such a way that k times eta naught k is defined as this cutoff divided by h. Yes.
Which of these k would you use? I mean, there are three k.
Yeah. So I will use. So we'll scale out the k1. That's what we do, and then this will be k1. So it's. So what we'll see here is K1 interval.
K1 is the largest?
Yes, actually, I should have mentioned it. Yeah. So if we wouldn't do that, and this is kind of important, if we would not have done that, so if you would have kept this eta naught to just be some initial spatial surface, initial spatial slice, then it means that we would treat different modes, different k's, differently. They would have less time, for instance, before they start crossing the horizon. And if you do that, you immediately, from the get-go, you're going to break scale invariance in these calculations. Because the three-point function picks up, basically, something from this integral, basically from the time eta naught to horizon crossing, let's say. So if these times are different for the different k modes, you're going to get different results for different k. And it'll break scale invariance. So we want to keep scale invariance. It is crucial for the kind of analysis we want to do, because in the previous slide, where I introduced these techniques to analyze shapes, it is actually assumed that the shapes are scale invariant. If they aren't, then it becomes more tricky. For the in product and stuff like that, you have to redefine completely. So we want to use these tools that I've introduced on the previous slide, so I want to keep scaling that. That also means that this is This is in the spirit of what is called, what sometimes called, new physics hyperservice approach. So if you remember, many years ago, Ulf Dinesen came up with an approach for how you would modify the initial state. You would wait until a particular mode crosses some proton scale, and then you would locally put it in some once-daily state. And because you would do that for all different modes separately, the end result would be if you get a specific modification of the initial state, which, you know, which you wrote a paper about. And this is also what we do in a way here, although we won't make any prediction, we will not depend on an actual expression for beta, the Bob-Lubov of Prandtl. We will keep that arbitrary. But scale invariance already tells us that we have to be in more or less in this picture. Okay?
So, but why do you call it then initial conditions? Because it's not initial conditions.
Okay, fine. That's easy.
It's got a sub-zero point.
It's an initial condition for every mode separately.
Okay.
So it's not defined on a hypersphere.
On a hypersphere.
Could you give me the other choice of type of that
algorithm? Actually, no. I would be very interested to discuss with you about the other case because. So the thing is, you get also enhancement factors, I'm sure. But those will be scale dependent, so they will be largest at highest at high k. And to analyze scale dependent on Gaussianities is, of course, one of your hobbies, I believe. And I don't know how to analyze compared to the data that particular set.
But I guess I'm not asking compared to the data.
Well, I mean, if you by that mean that at low k it will just disappear, yes, that's true. But it doesn't mean, as far as I can tell, it doesn't mean that it's not going to be, doesn't have any observational effects.
It's only the equals before horizon.
So in the Ulf approach, In Ulf's approach,
yes.
The result depends on which canonical Hamiltonian you minimalize on the new physics hypersurface. But this ambiguity is taking into account that you keep the beta free. No?
So, in Ulf's approach, basically what I understand from the paper is rather straightforward. Just wait until a particular one crosses the horizon, then put it in a local one-day free state, basically a local one-day state. If you do that for every mode separately, that means that you're going to predict beta as a function of k.
But it depends on the canonical Hamiltonian that you, you can do a transformation of canonical variables. And
yes.
If you do it for another set of canonical variables, you get another result.
Yes, I think so.
Yes, yeah, so I'm just asking if that ambiguity is contained and you're keeping beta free.
No, we're not going to use Ulf's approach. I'm not saying that we're not going to make any assumption on what this beta is. We're going to keep it free, right? So the only reason I mentioned Ulf in this talk, if he's watching, the only reason I mentioned him is that it seems that if you want to keep scale invariance in the speedwave function, you're basically automatically going misdirected. You should think about it in terms of new physics hypersurface approach, which is basically also what he. Right, so that's all this, but I will keep beta free. I'll not make any assumptions on beta. Okay, so now what I need is an interaction Hamiltonian, and in slow roll inflation, well, that's sort of known to me. This is the interaction Hamiltonian in terms of the canonical curvature perturbation variable, and I'm now going to, as he consider a modification to the user one stable state. Usual way. And also, don't worry too much if you see the real part, the imaginary part of the absolute value of beta. I'm going to say that they're all kind of similar because I'm not going to keep track of whether it's the imaginary part, real part, typically. So, for my purposes, they'll all be more or less the same value. And I'll do a first order expansion in beta. Now, if you do that in the specific context of slow roll inflation, so no high derivative corrections whatsoever. You get this result, which was, first written down in this particular way by Holman and Tolley. And what you find is that this maximizes distributed function, and he unfolded our collinear limit, where h2 plus h3 is 1. So that's on this, this one. So what we did, we took that three-point function, and we wanted to know the projection of the local and equilateral temper to see what kind of constraints you could actually deduce from this particular modification of the three-point function. Now, first, I want to show you that indeed there's some enhancement going on. So let's define, so take this three-point function and rewrite it in terms of the variables h2, h3, and k1. Define this to be the amplitude. So you see that it's suppressed because there's, of course, slow roll suppression. That's reasonable because we're doing slow roll suppression. We know that it's slow roll suppressed. Then there is this beta, the Lubov parameter. And then this would be the shape. Now, there's a subleading part, and I basically want to concentrate on this term. So there's an oscillating part, and in this oscillating part, there's a cosine k180. So what this means, if you look at this function carefully, is that there will be a localized k180 enhancement because this function maximizes at this point. h2 plus h3 minus 1 is pi over k180. This means that a k180 will appear as enhancing the localized signal. And this k180 can be a large number, so it will be a large peak in this three-point function. Okay? So we're going to determine the leakage into local and equilateral to be able to put a constraint, if possible. Or another thing that you could try to do, because of course, in a perfect world, what you would like to do is develop a template that would fit precisely onto this theoretical shape, and take the template, bring it to your favorite cosmologists, and compare it to the data. So we actually made a proposal for a template, but it turned out to be a rather bad template. So although it peaks in the unfolded limit, it didn't compare very well with this particular theoretical shape. So I'm not going to talk about it too much today, because I want to focus on other things. So when you determine this leakage or this fudge factor, what is important also is to realize that you have to calculate the norm of this shape. And why is it important to look at this norm of the shape? Because the norm of the shape actually tells you how well you can do if you would have an optimal template. So let's say you want to develop an optimal template, then this norm is going to tell you how well you can do. Because what you actually measure is the amplitude times the norm, so the square root of this. So even though there's linear enhancement because of this fact of the three-point function, because it is localized, when you integrate over all triangles available, you will lose some of that linear enhancement. This is basically being shown by this square root of this function, because basically what's left is the square root of k180. So if you have the best template in the world that fits with the shape, you're still going to lose the square root of the enhancement, just because you integrate over all triangles. Yes?
I have a question about that shape. So, as you're saying, that shape peaks for unfolded triangles, but it actually F diverges there, right? Even though all momenta are finite. No?
It doesn't diverge.
It does not?
It becomes actually this function is just finite. Expand it. So expand it. Take the limit. Let's write this as x. Put a k180 here and a k180 in front, and you have 1 minus cosine x over x.
The denominator was 0, but also the numerator was 0.
Yeah. So it should be finite, because otherwise, okay.
Sorry, I was just looking at the denominator.
Yeah, sorry. No, it's an important point, actually, because.
So on that limit, don't you have the subleading terms dominating?
Well, okay, so the subleading terms I wrote down here are basically the ones because these are lines that basically functions that depend, that are constant on lines like this through the diagram. There are also functions that are constant on lines like this through the diagram. And in fact, you can show, and those are the subleading terms in here, and you can show that they have a small effect in these corners. But It's not going to be.
So seeing that something if you expand instead of BL1, you expand the BL1 square, beta k square, for example.
Ah.
Then I would think that if the wrong level minus 1 minus x2 plus x3, would that go up?
And so I haven't looked at that. So the honest answer is I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know what happens if you go to higher order in beta.
I one day I was just playing around and expand the higher order and then saw it go up. So
you should definitely continue playing around that. I didn't look at that.
Can you see the Mongolian connection again? Is it just a linear integral?
No, this is just arbitrary. Now, of course, so if this beta k would be strongly dependent on k, then it will also break scaling rate, of course. And so I more or less, so I don't make any assumptions of beta k, but you know, I have, in the back of my head, I typically think of it as a constant number, which is basically not depending on k.
Can I understand this enhancement? I mean, it's really gamma over h. So for arbitrarily low scales, the enhancement is arbitrarily large, right? Is there some intuition behind why you get an arbitrarily large enhancement? When
yes, there is. Well, you want me to tell you now?
If it's coming later.
No, but here's where I can tell you now. Because the intuition is, of course, that if you have, for example, it's better even to, it's easier to see actually when you have high derivative interactions in your but even here it's clear what happens. So what happens is that if you start to modify your initial state at some time a or not, that basically means that you start inducing, you occupy some states. So there's some particles in your system. And these particles, if they have interactions, and they always do, in this case they are gravitational in nature, they already start working from the time a to naught to produce a three-point function. So that's why this scale m over h appears, because that's the separation between basically the scatter scale and the rising cross. So that's why, so it has time to build a three-point function, because there are already particles in the system. That's why I get this.
Maybe another interesting question. Why is, I think the Schatten shape or the unfolded shape is the one that dominates the physics intuition for that?
Well, I think you could probably say something like, okay, so you know that the local shape is basically because, you know, actually, it's infinite. Right? If you extend it into these corners, basically because the three-point function grows after the rise of Russell. And if you consider the true infrared limit k to zero, you go infinitely. But of course, you don't see that natural infrared color. So that grows after the rise of Russell. The equilateral, you actually add the rise of Russell, and this, in some sense, gets starts. Before the horizon cross. So that's basically how you should probably understand.
It's a resonance effect, it's just the energy conservation, right? So you K1 is taking the space.
Yeah.
Also, is there a stricter refraction rather than just H plus M? Because there's some difference on how.
Sorry, so can you repeat? I didn't hear.
Sorry, is there more restrictive strength just than H less than M? Is there some thing about how much you change beta?
Is there
how much you can deviate?
There are these constraints on beta, of course, on back beta.
Right. So what is that?
Oh, okay. So they're kind of mild. So I didn't spend time on them here, but I think the bounds that you have from the two-point functions are, you know, they're stronger than the back reaction bounds. So I mean, you can think of a beta of at the order of 10 minus 2, and still a lot. I mean, on the border, but the power spectrum tells you that it should not be a lot bigger.
But there's no combined constraint combining M, H, and beta,
but
some sort of back
reaction. Well, in the end, you have to satisfy all the constraints. Right? So there will be. There will be combined constraints, yes.
Oh, you mean beta at times?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's a back reaction of beta squared times some stuff.
Yeah.
Less
sure.
than, and, you know,
H2. Sure.
Okay. Less.
Sure. Okay, so these plots are probably completely invisible to most of you in the back, but I'll just stand here and try to point out the important parts of it. So what I've plotted here are essentially the fudge factors. So the functions that determine how much leakage there is into the local and equilateral shape. And what you want those functions to be is as large as possible. The larger they are, the better constraints you can put on these kinds of initial state modifications. And so they should, in other words, they should be growing functions of k1 eight and not. Then that would be great. But it turns out if you do the calculations, and we can do those actually in this particular case, we can do those almost analytically, that if you look at the fudge factor, now you cannot really read this, but I don't even read this. I know for a fact that this one, okay, so this one, that's basically the fudge factor as a function of k1 eta naught, comparing this particular theoretical shape of modified initial state with the local temple. So what you see is it remains constant. So there's no enhancement effect in the projection to the local temple. So in other words, you don't see it. I mean, you don't get strong constraints. And the same is true for equilateral. It's even lower than fudge factor, but that's just an order. These are just some other one differences, so it doesn't matter. But there's no growth with k1 eta naught. So it's not going to give you strong constraints. And this particular line is for this enfolded template that we introduced, but although this grows a little bit, it's turning around and becomes constant. It's a little bit bigger than those two, but it's not going to help as much, because you really want something that's a function of k1 eta naught. Now, what you really need to do, of course, to translate into constraint is go to the 2D CMB sphere. Now, these are the three-dimensional results. And it's a known fact that not much happens if you take these numbers and project them onto the two-dimensional sphere, because essentially, this is already taking care of the fact that you integrate over all triangles. And what happens when you go to 2D is basically there's a set of 3D triangles that contributes to a single 2D triangle. So it's going to give you a little bit of an extra, I mean, probably the fudge factors will be a little bit bigger, but the nature of it, the dependency of k1 eta naught, does not change much. And in fact, that's also what we see here. So we did the calculations. I have to admit that I didn't do that. Pierre Stefano and Dan, my student, did them. They use CMB fast and consider the flat space limit. So you don't really look at the finite size of the sphere. And they did all the calculations, and what they find is basically a similar conclusion, that for this particular case, although this theoretical shape is enhanced, the templates that we have are not adequate. They won't see this. So they can't put interesting constraints. Okay. So now what happens if you add a higher derivative correction? So there's a specific higher derivative interaction that we considered, as is the same that you guys considered, and it was first considered by Feminelli. So we consider adding a high derivative term like this. This will change the interaction Hamiltonian in this particular way. And now you go ahead and calculate again. So you calculate the three-point function, and you change the initial state. And what you find is that there are actually a couple of terms that appear that are leading. Terms that are oscillating and have a k tilde in the denominator, where k tilde, I should have written that somewhere, but I didn't. K tilde is, yes, so k tilde is this function here. It's the sum of all the momenta minus 2 times one of the momenta. So that gives you a minus sign for one of the momenta, essentially. That's always what happens if you modify the initial state. You get basically flip one sign in the momenta, basically because you add a part to the wave function which is basically the complex function, right? That's what you do when you group an estimation. So there's this k tilde squared here in the denominator, is a k tilde in the denominator, and then there's an extra term, which is actually doesn't have a k tilde in the denominator. So whenever you have a k tilde in the denominator, there will be localized enhancement. It will be localized because these functions basically peak at some value close to zero. And so there will be a k1 eta naught there will be a K1 eta not picked up because basically this this sign is a function of K-tilde times eta not. So whenever you have these K-tildes in the denominator, you will have localized enhancement. But here you see that there is a term which is basically has an overall enhancement with eta not squared, which will combine one of these K1s with your K1 eta not squared. So there will be overall enhanced term and localized enhanced terms, and in fact they are going to be in the same order in some particular positions in this domain. So it's a complicated shape, and it's actually not the enfolded type. So these two terms, they peak in these enfolded limits. But in addition, there's this term, and this one peaks essentially everywhere in the domain, right? So it's not the enfolded type. And what you also see is that in general, there will be a K1 eta not squared enhancement. So this will give you a K1 eta not squared. Here there will be a K1 eta not squared coming directly from this K-tilde squared. Here is an eta not combining with this 1 over K-tilde gives you also a K1 eta not squared. So the signal is huge. You'll have a huge three-point function if you add this higher input. Now, this is actually, in some sense, agreeing with what you guys found. I think that you immediately took the enfolded limit. So we find the extra term which is overall enhanced. Actually, the end result will be more or less the same because of the reasons that I will now explain. In the sense that all these terms, they contribute if you project onto local or equilateral states. But the overall enhanced term is oscillating. And it's also, so these Q's and P's, they are polynomials in K. I didn't write them down. But this term oscillates around zero. It changes sign every time. So that means that if you take the inner product with the local or equilateral template, it will vanish. It will be very, very, very small, basically because it's an oscillating term. And if you do the calculations, defining the amplitude and the shapes, again, introducing H2 and H3, all that stuff. And what you find is that you will lose one factor of K1 eta naught. So instead of K1 eta naught squared, you will find K1 eta naught enhancement. So this fudge factor grows linearly. So that means that the constraints, in principle, can become strong. The sad part, is that the three terms, they conspire in a way that there's a different sign between these two terms here, for example, that in the relevant domain between 100 and 1,000, the actual value of the fudge factor is smaller than you would think on the basis of scaling alone, basically because they're cancellations.
100 to
1,000. Yeah, from 100. So K1 is natural, I would say natural to pick it somewhere between 100 and 1,000. So you don't have to do that, but that's what we typically would assume. So I have to say that we did this calculation using, well, semi-analytically, we did parts with numerically, and we neglected oscillatory contributions, because that's just hard to do. But they are there, and in fact, because there are cancellations, so this thing actually goes to zero somewhere in the relevant domain, that means that these oscillatory contributions, they can be important at some point, close to where this first factor becomes zero. So there might be some, they're bound to be some, the actual number are bound to be a little bit different than this. So I already explained the sign difference in here. It uses the fudge factor from what you would just expect on the basis of scaling alone. We'll find actually a similar expression for equilateral, so this is the local sphere. But what we're left with is linear enhancement. So, what does that mean, linear enhancement? So Caminelli showed that if you add such a term to your inflationary model, then what you would get in terms of non-Gaussianities would be a non-Gaussianity of the equilateral type, which would have an amplitude something like this, where lambda is a coupling, so you can safely assume to be 1. And this is always going to be smaller or equal to 1. So it's undetectably small at the moment, but nevertheless, that's what it is. And what happens here now is that we have
an enhancement factor k on eta naught. So you should think of that as saying that this number will be enhanced by beta times m over h. Now beta times n over h is, you know, maximally going to be 10 or a little bit more than 10. This number is going to be, 10 or a little bit more than 10. So that means that this is going to be enhanced to like level at level of 10, which means that, you know, in the future, who knows, you might be able to see this. I don't know, but this is an interesting number. Of course, we would like this to be even bigger, but let's do this.
What is constraining that number to be less than 10?
Well, okay, so you want this cutoff scale to be smaller than the Planck scale, because otherwise you don't know what's going on. So that means that there's a constraint, an upper bound on how large this can be, right? And beta is at most 10 minus 2. So it could, I mean, I'm not saying it could be a little bit bigger. I mean, it could be maybe 100. But I would say in the domain of that we have considered, like from 100 to 1,000, this is the best you for m over h. And this is basically what you would expect the enhancement to do.
But h can be very small, so I don't know.
What about those kinds
of things? Sorry, what can be small?
H, Hubble can be very small. So why do you say
H, yes, that's true. H can be very small. Yes, that's true. No, you're right, that's true. If H, so I guess what we have in mind always is this, that this H is close to the gut scale. In principle, of course, H can be a lot smaller than that, and then, of course, also the there's the ratio M over H can be a lot bigger than principle. That's right. So I think it's, you're right, actually. So it's a, more or less a choice that we tend to think of this number as somewhere between 100 and 1,000, but it could be a lot bigger. But there is a bound because of, we don't want this N to be as large as the classical, right?
There's actually a bound on M over H from just the power spectrum. I mean, there's a possibility.
Yeah, but there is for an open bound, there's also a thing.
Yeah.
So that's.
Okay, so beta is the bound comes from what? Power spectrum gives you a bound on which combination?
The power spectrum gives you a bound directly on beta. Also, no, I mean, it gives you a bound on beta. If you remember this old stuff, you know, for the two-point function, what happens is that you get basically a resonance effect. And in the models that were considered, like for example, this Danielson model, this beta was h over n, essentially. And it would give you small oscillations in the two-point function. And the Dolimap 3-year data actually had a section on these things, and they are typically, they constrain to be, you know, smaller than 10 minus 2.
But you're not using there as a model, right? Because
no, I don't use a model. I don't use a model. Right. This is arbitrary. This is
right.
Beta is arbitrary.
So I'm confused. Beta is constrained by the power spectrum, or beta times some power m over h.
This is the three. Sorry. This is the constraint from the three-point function alone.
Okay.
This is not taking into account two-point function.
Okay.
This is just what I get from the three-point function.
So three-point function tells you it's less than 10.
Yes.
Doesn't matter what beta and m over h.
Yes.
Okay. And two-point will just constrain on beta.
Yes.
Which is like 10 minus 2.
Yes. This is not, no, this is a three-point function, not
but
a
this
two-point.
This is not a constraint, this is just an estimate of size.
Yeah, okay, good. So, of course, this is.
I mean, if you put the data in, you would get an actual constraint on. If you use the data, you could put the three-point and the two-point, you could exactly constrain beta and 10 over.
Separate. You mean for the two-point function, for the
Yes,
definitely. But I'm only looking at the three-point function here because I want to get across the idea that it's already quite remarkable that the three-point function, which is not as well measured as the two-point function, it's more difficult to measure, is already going to give you, you know, comparable constraints. Anyway. It's not that far off. So I'm just looking, don't worry about it. This is just three-point function.
Okay.
But it's true that if you minimize the energy and the new physics hypersurface, then you would get h over m for beta.
Yeah, of course. Then you get basically for beta, if you use a model for beta, let's say beta is h over m,
yeah.
then of course you get a constraint basically on the cutoff scale.
Also, I mean, beta has k dependence when you look at the back reaction.
That's right. That's the whole point I asked.
Right.
But you assume that's not.
That's right. But you can also, if you make the statement that the vacuum, you still want the vacuum to be Hadamard or close to Hadamard, then that kind of constrains the functional dependence of beta on k.
Right.
So get other constraints out.
Yeah.
Yes. No, but the Hadamard constraint basically tells you that you should not, you know, consider any extra basis beyond.
Right. So you don't want to be exactly Hadamard. You want to be like beta or, you know, close to Hadamard. You can certainly do that. Or you can just not do that and let it flow.
So we have not considered like k dependence of beta. I mean, we just did our calculations basically assuming, I guess, the data results.
Mm-hmm. And that's important in this enhancement, right? If you had beta turned off to above some point, then you wouldn't be getting this enhancement by error rate.
Yeah, you do. So the point is that I've never considered in any calculation done so far, I've never considered betas or modifications of the initial state. I've never considered occupation numbers for states above some cutoff. I've never done it. This is only these are only modifications for modes after they cross some cutoff.
But the cutoff is m, right? So
yes.
So if I made m, if I was following up Liam's question, I made m, you know, 10 to the millionth Planck scales or something.
Yeah, okay.
And I got some really ridiculously large thing.
Yeah.
What's happening?
That's excluded.
The reason that the reason that decoupling is failing is that you're actually populating states up extremely.
Yeah, but that's already ruled out by back reaction and everything else. I mean,
sure. But if it's kind of parametrically odd to have large scale over small scale, you're building it in by having beta being large up to large scale. So beta's not zero at large scale.
Well, not zero.
That's a much more naive question. I mean, the folded shape is
the
shape that you're
coupling.
Is it
vectorizable? No.
It's not.
Far.
Okay.
No, that's the whole point. I mean, the thing is, of course, that what we're doing here is in some sense non-optimal, because we're looking at projections of these theoretical shapes into the local and equilateral templates, whereas what we would really like to do, of course, is basically to take the shape, approximate it by some vectorizable template, and take the template compared to the data. That would give you a direct constraint from these kinds of non-Gaussians. And we tried that, but we were hopelessly unsuccessful. I mean, they didn't. Well, we have some ideas of it, but it's important.
Yeah.
Yes.
5 minutes.
Yes.
So coming back to Cliff's question. So would you agree that your modification of the initial state is in fact infinitely populated in the UV?
No, it's not.
How is it possible?
Well, if you want, basically for all modes, so I'm only occupying states after they cross the cutoff.
Yeah,
before that, I'm not going to consider any excitations.
But so
because that will be.
For instance, if you keep m constant and send eta naught to minus infinity, these modifications do survive, I guess.
You're saying. Eta naught, you can't take eta naught to, why would you do that?
Sorry, what?
Eta naught to minus infinity.
I don't know what you mean by eta, but I guess what I'm saying is that. So
eta naught.
Suppose you have infinitely many efforts of inflation.
Yeah.
Okay, so whatever state that is not infinitely populated in the UV is going to approach Max Davis.
So you're keeping
beta independent of k is effectively saying that your shape is.
It kind of
so,
is
like the beginning
sorry.
Of inflation.
So maybe I can answer it this way. So I'm not exactly doing effective theory, but I'm trying to be ignorant about everything that goes on above the particular cutoff. So for every mode that I see in the sky, I follow it backwards until the time it hits the cutoff scale. Before that, I don't care. I don't know. We just don't know. And after a time, it can have small excitations.
It's basically constant over a range.
Yeah.
That's the assumption he's making.
Constant over a range.
Right.
And the range is?
The range is observable, whatever is observable. Outside the range, you can set it.
You can make it fall off so that you don't get.
He's making a number of assumptions
which he needs to calculate.
That's right. But you specify clearly yourself with the one it is.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm saying, I guess I'm saying that, those assumptions are not stable against removing the beginning of inflation.
Oh, that's true.
So there's an assumption here that we don't have too many inputs of inflation.
But I think we decided it has nothing to do with the beginning of inflation. It's just
I was misunderstanding it enough, but I'm saying that the physical point I'm making is that it's crucial
that
we don't have too many
inputs. If you have an infinite number of inputs, and you only and if you don't have UV, the highest UV scales populated, then in the end what you will end up for the physical scales of seeing the sky is Bill Zales.
Right.
Okay, I have 0 minutes.
we'll give it 2.
Okay, so in the context of this this higher derivative term that I've added, we can actually try to translate it into a. So this is just a quick estimation based on the three-dimensional fudge factor that I calculated, but of course, if you really want to compare the data, you calculate the two-dimensional fudge factor, so you have to project to the two-dimensional smooth sphere. Now, actually, that's quite complicated. Kerr, Stefano, and Dan were able to do the numerical stuff to get some answers, but it involves making an assumption for M over 8. So in particular, if M over 8 is 10 to the third, is 1,000, then you know that this two-dimensional fudge factor is 6,000. In that particular case, that means, so assuming that M over 8 is 1,000, you can turn the constraint on FNL local into a constraint on beta. And then what you get is this, 4 times 10 to the first times beta, it has to be smaller than 111. So and this is already comparable with power spectrum constraint. And I'd like to again remind you that an optimal template would deliver another factor of M over H. So that would really make this constraint a lot better. If you can find a template that actually factorizable template that resembles the theoretical shape a lot better.
If you have order one beta, which is what you would get from that constraint, wouldn't you have order one corrections for your power spectrum as well?
This is not going to give you order one data. Why is this order one data? It's not order one. It's 10 minus 1, 10 minus 2 is your sketch.
Yeah, but okay, but.
But that's what I'm saying. It's like it's comparable to the two-point function in that sense.
Yeah, so that is something that you would be able to see in the two-point function as well.
Yeah, So it's not better than the two-point function, definitely not. But for this is early days measuring a three-point function, so I'm still quite impressed that this is possible. So I'm going to skip the DBI part because this is work in progress. I was going to tell you a little bit about why maybe perhaps in DBI inflationary setups it makes some sense to talk about initial state modifications. Just briefly, well, essentially it's because you have a finite throat and some constraints. In strongly scale-dependent scenarios, you can have a constraint on the total number of epochs. If this is rather small, then it means that actually any initial state that you put here is probing the bulk region. So it might be interesting to consider those setups and look at the initial state modifications. Now, Richard, also, you mentioned something about the fact that DBI, if you do the calculation for DBI, as compared to the high derivative terms that I added, that you would probably get something similar. The fact is that we don't find something similar is because in the high derivative case, that's one thing I would like to mention. In the high derivative case, there's if you look at the details of the calculation, there's a k-tilde that drops out. You can actually get, there's a k-tilde in the actual three-point function calculation that suddenly appears in front and kills one of the k-tildes in the denominator. And so in fact, it doesn't happen in the DBI bispectrum, so you get a k-tilde to the third. So that means that you get an extra localized enhancement with an extra factor of M over H, as far as you can tell right now. So you will lose again because it's localized, And if you integrate them all triangles, you will lose another factor of m over 8, but then the end result will be m over 8 squared. And of course, it will also depend on the sound, speed of sound. And so we're trying to work out the constraints if we can get this way, because now we also have to take into account the fact that there are constraints on equilateral triangle Gaussian entries from basically DBI inflation. So this is ongoing work with John and Mark Jackson next week. So conclusions, just to finish off. Non-Gaussian entities are an excellent probe of high elliptic interactions and the initial state. So I assumed here, so just a couple of remarks. I assumed the scale invariant new physics hyperfluid surface scenario. Different analysis techniques are necessary if you want to use a boundary effective field theory approach. That means if you pick a hypersurface to set an initial state, then you have to use different analysis techniques. Where Dan is working on that, I'm not nearly involved. And that will produce scale dependent on Gaussianities, which are also kind of interest, I noticed recently, so maybe it's worthwhile to think about that. And of course, it's also interesting to consider higher endpoint functions, because in principle, for every higher endpoint function, you might expect larger powers of K1 8 and 0. So, what I have in mind is, in some sense, that these constraints will become stronger even for higher endpoint functions, and then for all practical purposes, maybe in the end, you are left with the Bunce Davis state, which I would find kind of comforting for. Okay, thank you.
In the interest of time, can we just move on to the next talk, and then we'll sort of afterwards just do a long Q&A session. So the next speaker is Thorsten Bader.